Hi, everybody. Here we are again. It's Monday. It's 1 o'clock Israel time. I should actually mention that we go by Israel time. I think those of you watching perhaps overseas or see this maybe get a little bit confused as a result. Anyways, welcome back to Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers, History and Hashkafa. This is brought to you by the Tel Aviv International Synagogue, under the inspired leadership of Rabbi Ariel Constantine, who created this incredible, over the course of Corona, created this incredible series. Every day, another class, provided by all kinds of interesting and amazing and intriguing people. And welcome. Last week, we actually finished an entire Mishnah, which is strange for us, but that's the way it goes. We are now in the second chapter of Pirkei Avot. We are in the seventh Mishnah, continuing a series of aphorisms which were attributed to Hillel the Elder, who lived at the end of the first century BCE and the beginning of the first century CE, probably contemporary of Jesus, the founder of Christianity, but that's neither here nor there at the moment. Okay, so one of the things that Hillel's comments are noted for. If you see, there's a line that sort of unites them. If you go over the last few weeks' classes, then you realize that he formulates his words in terms of if there's this, there's this. If there's this, there's that. If there's not something, there's something else. And he connects things. He makes things, one thing, various things conditional on other things. And that theme or that style continues in our in this Mishnah. We are not going to be able to finish this Mishnah today for the very simple reason it's just too pregnant with meaning and too many angles. But we will try to get half through. But I'll read through the whole. We'll read through the whole thing once, and then try to get a handle on what it means. He would say, "Hu haya omer." I'll read it in Hebrew first, and then we'll read. Then I'll translate it. "Hu haya omer, marbe basar, marbe rima, marbe nechasim, marbe something, daaga, or marbe dayo, marbe shfachot, marbe zima, marbe avadim." מרבה גזר, מרבה נשים, מרבה כשפים, מרבה תורה, מרבה חוכמה, מרבה עצה, מרבה תבונה, מרבה צדקה, מרבה שלום, קנה שם טוב, קנה לעצמו, קנה לו דברי תורה, קנה לו חיי עולם הבא. There's a few differences of opinion as to what exactly the text is. I read you from the first edition, the best manuscript of the Mishnah. It's called the Kaufman manuscript. Has some differences, which we will some of which I'll point out to you. But what does it mean? He would say, the more meat, the more worms; the more possessions, the more worry; the more wealth, the more worry. Okay, just excuse me a minute. I understand that the live video on the here has stopped. Give me just 1 second to try it again. I don't know why that happened. Please bear with me. And we're back. Okay, I apologize. Hold on. We are starting live streaming. According to this. Okay. All right, so we were saying that we are discussing here the first Mishnah, the seventh Mishnah. I read through the Hebrew and in the second chapter. And I'm going to read it. So I'll start reading the translation again. Hillel would say, the more meat, the more worms. The more wealth, or the more possessions, the more worry. The more women, the more sorcery. The more maidservants, the more sexual profligacy. The more slaves, the more theft. The more Torah, the more life. The more sitting and studying, the more time spent in a Beit Midrash, perhaps, we'll see, the more wisdom. The more advice, the more understanding. The more, I don't want to say charity, the more alms, the more acts of giving money to the poor, those who need marbeh shalom, the more peace there will be. If you get yourself a good reputation, a good name, if you acquire for yourself a good name or a good reputation, then you've done something really major for yourself. If you've acquired for yourself Divrei Torah, if you've managed to get yourself Jewish education or to study something new in Torah, then you've actually gained yourself a place in the next world. So, this has probably set off not a few people, setting off a few bells here, because there's a lot of things here that are A, not clear, and B, they sound misogynistic. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. I don't know. Let's see. Let's get cracking. Okay. Marbe basar, marbe rima. First of all, what's clear is, let's look at the overall structure of the Mishnah. Clear is that this is something of a polemic against too much materialism. It's an anti-materialist polemic. Notice, okay, too much of this, too much of that. Apparently, it's not bad to have them within proper measure. So it's not too much meat, too many wives. Just don't forget, they're talking about a period in which you, even though Jews generally did not have more than one wife, the general trend among Jews was always monogamous. It is also true that polygamy was practiced among Jews, certainly in the ancient period. It certainly is true in terms of Franco-German Jewry, Ashkenazic Jewry, until the 11th century. And among Mizrahi Jews, it depends on where, all the way down to the down to the modern era. So too many wives, too many slaves, too many maidservants, and that raises another question. Which I was accosted by once by a student. I had the privilege. It hasn't happened since Corona, unfortunately. But I had the privilege for about 5-6 years to have the time to sit in the Haratzion Yeshivat Haratzion Beit Midrash, which is right near by where I live, two three times a week and sit and learn, just not for research, just to learn Torah. And for whatever reason, I was always the one that some of the Rebbeim, some of the teachers would send their students with the odd questions or the difficult questions to. So it was one student who was really being eaten up alive by the fact that the Torah countenances slavery. And here, the Mishnah seems to say, too many slaves is no good. Too many maidservants is no good. But having a few slaves, what could be bad? I don't want to get involved with cancel culture and all this other stuff, but I think we have to realize that as bad as slavery is, it is has been a permanent feature of the world economy since for time immemorial. It still exists in the Middle East. It still exists in Africa. It still exists in Eastern Asia. So it's there. It's a fact. Up until up until the modern era, and even then, because the serfs were still in Russia and so on, economies could not function without slavery. I'm not making an apology, but I'm trying to say that it wasn't possible to set up any kind of economy, an economic system, without taking into consideration. So the Torah did the best it could in those circumstances. And that was first of all, a slave is not just a slave is a person. It's not a chattel. slave, if a Jew were to buy a slave or a maidservant, that person became almost Jewish. It's just do the best you can, and to condemn. The Torah had to be given in a context in which it could exist. There is no mitzvah to have slaves, but if there are slaves, the Torah tries to make life humanly possible. Interestingly, by the way, just as a matter of, I know I'm digressing, but interestingly, a colleague and neighbor of mine, Professor Ami Reiner, wrote an article. Both in Hebrew and in French, which I don't think is going to help a lot of people here, maybe some of the French speakers. Anyways, read an article relatively recently in which he points out that there were a significant number of converts to Judaism in the early and central Middle Ages. And he proves very nicely that, or very persuasively, everything he does is good. He proves that, in fact, most of these converts were actually slaves who had been freed. When a Jew, according to halacha, if a person buys a slave or buys a maidservant, then they become part Jewish. They go to mikveh and they become partly Jewish. And when they're freed, they become fully Jewish. They're Jews like everybody else, and they stay in the Jewish community. Which indicates that even those Jews who had slaves, and there weren't, I'm not impressed with the number of Jews who had slaves, but even those that had slaves, ultimately, if not inevitably, ended up freeing them, and these people became part of the Jewish community. And they at some stage they, you know, married in and became part of, you know, part of the Jewish community. I'm not saying they weren't, you know, comments about, you know, that every newcomer has in a community, but it's a fact. So, by the way, those people who argue that that blonde Jews and blue-eyed Jews are testimony to the various things that happened from passing Crusaders and Cossacks, it ain't necessarily so. It's very possible that they're just, you know, somewhere along the line, they descended among other people because everybody married everybody else. From these slaves. Anyways, let's leave the slavery alone for a minute. Let's go back to here. So first of all, it's a very anti-materialist polemic, where on the first part, if you have too much of the material stuff, you're going to suffer. A. However, if you really emphasize your spiritual efforts, if you study more, if you sit in yeshiva more, if you seek more advice or more counsel from people that are wiser, if you give more tzedakah, if you work on your reputation as a moral and an estimable human being, then everything will be fine. In other words, there are places where you should overdo it. You shouldn't overdo it. And there are places where there's no end to what you can achieve and what you should do. So clearly, that's number one. Let's take the first two couplets in the Mishnah, and then I want to use that to go off in a sort of a different direction. Marbe basar, marbe rima. If you eat too much meat, or if you have too much meat on you, as a result, there'll be more worms. Now, what does that mean? So all of this is like, I, you know, initially when I was a kid and I first saw this Mishnah and I was like, well, 11, 12, whatever it was, I said, oh, that's because they didn't have refrigeration. So if you have too much meat in, you know, if you don't have too much meat around, if you have too much meat around, then it's going to end up getting the worms will come and they'll eat it and you won't have what to eat. But that's not how, and that would fit, by the way. That would fit, by the way, with if you have too much wealth, then you're going to be worried about it. So I'll be worried about the meat in the ersatz refrigerator that I have. But that's not the way that most interpret it. The way that most commentators interpret it is that the more that you eat, okay, the more that you indulge yourself gastronomically, that's not going to help you in the end of days. In other words, indulging yourself as a gourmand, that's not going to help you. On the contrary, marve basar, marve rima. All that's going to do is means that when you go in the ground, the worms will have a field day with you. Only charity and good news will save you ultimately from spiritual death in the next world. It sounds very grubby, but it's interesting. It's a topic that I've always wanted to touch on, and I'm actually in the middle of reviewing a book on the subject. We have a how to put this queasy attitude towards the physical and towards towards life and towards death. Let me explain what I mean. There is a book that I read as a freshman in college, which was aggressive, polemical, and yet I still think is one of the most important books I've ever read on topics such as these. The book was called The Pursuit of Loneliness by a sociologist named Philip Slater. Slater, I might even still have the copy here somewhere. Slater, point by point, it's very much a product of the late 60s, early 70s. Slater, point by point, picks at what he sees to be the negative parts of modern society. He has a chapter which he calls the toilet assumption, which again sounds grubby. It's very, you know, it makes you uncomfortable. What's the toilet assumption? He said, and he points out, but here I think he really hits on to something. He says that in the up until the modern era, up until the 20th century, he says, people were not afraid of the grubbier parts of life. He didn't put it that way. I didn't go look for the book, so I can't read you the passage. He says they lived easily or lived less queasily with bodily functions, with going to the bathroom, with the presence of waste around. I mean, I'm not saying it's the most hygienic thing in the world, but I'm talking about the emotional reaction. Dirty diapers, chamber pots, and death, and sickness. When hospitals are not a place you went. People were sick at home, they were cared for at home, and they died at home. If you look at all of the halachot that describe the procedures about what happens if, God forbid, somebody dies, then you see immediately that everything's happening at home. People die surrounded by, if they're lucky, surrounded by their families. And there's an entire procedure of, as you know, what you say as you think you're dying, and you're never alone, and there's all kinds of stuff that goes on. But it's all very public. There's a very important book by the great people say historian du dimanche, Sunday historian, Philippe Ariès, called in English it's called The Hour of Our Death. In French it's called L'homme devant la mort, man before death, man standing in front of death. All of these things were things that you saw. You didn't run away from them. And Slater says none of this is true anymore. So we take bodily waste and we flush it away. We don't see it. Which might be good. You know, it's good hygienically. It's also good aesthetically. But we also flush away our sick people and our dead people. People die in the hospital. Everything's very styptic and clean and sort of like characterless. We don't look at anything. We don't confront. We sort of pretend that things don't, that death, for example, doesn't happen. You know, I when I was a practicing rabbi many years ago, I would have to officiate at a funeral, or as it happened, I would be called to perform a funeral for somebody who I didn't know. You get to the proper way of the American way of death. There's a book about this, and this was printed already 50, 60 years ago. Was to cause the bereaved, the people at the funeral, the least amount of trauma, but to hide or to mask or to flush away, if you want to use Slater's words, the reality of the death of the person as much as humanly possible, so that you even when you get to the cemetery, you don't lower the casket. What they would do is, because that might be too traumatic, you cover it with a green cloth. Now, halachically, that's a problem, but that's not a burial. You have to put the person in the ground and you bury them and so on. But here was a matter of we sort of pretend like it didn't happen. We don't have to confront anything. That's not the way that first of all, it's not healthy, but second, psychologically. But it's the opposite of the way things went up until the 20th century, and it's the opposite of what the Torah requires, because the Torah requires that you look at life straight on. It's a mitzvah not to hide the burial of a person who passes away, but also that we participate in the burial. You look death straight in the face. You look at life straight in the face. You look at, and if you look in the second, in the third chapter of Masechet Brachot, the discussion is all about, and it's, everybody likes, it's the icky gemaras, right? It's the gemaras that talk about what happens if you're davening mincha someplace and there is waste around. What do you do? Which tells you that you're in a world which you have to deal with these things. In other words, it's we left the pungent, not pungent isn't the word, the blatant physicality of our lives was part of everybody's daily existence. That's okay. So that, why did I go off on this long digression? Simply because of marbe basar, marbe rima. The more, the heavier you are, the more you eat, the more flesh you have, this just hit for the worms. That's very disconcerting. But it's more disconcerting for us than it was for them. Because the awareness and the confrontation of a person with what happens to one's physical remains was just part of life. You should know, okay, keep in mind, the worms are going to get you. And it's not, it wasn't, it, it, it's supposed to make a point about priorities. Yeah, that's true. But this is not a point, but the point here is not to, not to traumatize, but to say, look, you've got to be, yeah, you got to prioritize. What are you going to invest in? So that's marbe basar, marbe rima. That's why Hillel was able to, or felt no compunction about expressing himself that way. We saw this earlier, we'll see this a little later, when we get to a caveat ben Mahalalel, who says that person comes from a petipas rucha, a smelly drop of semen, you know, that wasn't meant to disorient people. It's a fact, we know that, but you should realize and put things sometimes we euphemize ourselves to death. That's really the point. Anyways, let's come back to this. Marbe basar, marbe rima. Marbe nechasim, marbe daga. The more wealth you have, the more worry you have. I'm going to come, since I see it's coming, it's getting late. I'll come back to the second line next week. I told you this one's going to take us a while. But I do want to, but when it comes to Mar Be Basar, Mar Be Rima, I do want to make it, make something very clear. Mar Be means too much. Mar Be means if you go overboard. It does not mean be an ascetic. We've seen this. We've seen this consistently throughout Pirkei Avot. This whole idea of do less and have less. We talked about this last week also. No, 2 weeks ago, I'm sorry. We talked about this 2 weeks ago, that there is that you shouldn't go overboard, but asceticism is not a good idea either. Okay. We saw when we talked about lo kol ha-marbeh b'schorah machkim. If you get caught up in business, you're never going to become wise because you won't have time to learn. So something similar is over here. Maimonides says, I think, beautifully. In the third chapter of the Rules of Ethical Qualities, he says as follows. A person has to direct his heart and all of his actions in order to know God only. That's his major goal. So therefore, when he gets up and when he sits down, when he gets up, and everything he does should be aimed towards that. So how do you make a living? He says, Ketzad, says, how's this work? When you go into negotiations in business, or when you're involved in your trade to make a living, when you have your job, your purpose should not be only. Now, interesting. Lo yebli bo likvot mamon bilvad. Don't do these things only to make money, but it's the only that's important. Making money is fine. Making money is important. Making a living is a mitzvah. But he says that's not the end in itself. Eliyased dvorim ha'elu kedei shimtza dvorim shaguf tzarich lehem ma'achila u'shtiya v'shivat bayit v'nesiat isha. You do it in order to be able to prioritize and get the things that you need for your physical life, like eating and drinking and having a home and getting married and setting up a family. They have to be directed. So that's the marbeh. You have to eat. Don't starve yourself and don't afflict yourself. And yes, I know there's a noom and zoom and daily fasting and all this other stuff. That's also to be strong. Now, he's saying this against a very strong trend among, in certain Jewish circles, and certainly non-Jewish circles as well, towards asceticism, towards self-mortification. He obviously could not have been saying it about early Christians who were heavily into self-mortification because Jesus hadn't been born yet, or he was a baby, and Christianity certainly hadn't begun. But there were other groups in the Dead Sea area. There were all kinds of other pagan spiritual types that were running around. And the idea is that you've got to just prioritize. But it's not. It's walk. This is the famous golden mean. You walk the line. There is nothing wrong with eating meat. There is nothing wrong with having wealth. There is nothing. But they can't become ends in themselves. They have to be having them per se as a value, enjoying your life and enjoying your steak and enjoying your intricate and your sirloin. Well, Israel can't have sirloin. Hope stars, you can't have sirloin. That's how to do it. So it's the marbeh. It's the inveighing against too much, as my mother would say, zu viel ist ungesund. Too much is no good. It's not healthy. That's where you have to put the emphasis. Okay, as I said, we're gonna manage to do like one Mishnah or one line a week for a while. But I know, I think when we get to the second half, it'll be faster. And so in the meantime, please feel free to share this video. As always, it will be up on the TAAS Daily Shear site, on my Facebook page. You're really welcome to subscribe to my YouTube channel, where there's all kinds of other content. And please visit the other, take a look at the other wonderful classes that are offered by the Tel Aviv International Synagogue. And we will see you again next week. Be well. Bye.